My guest is writer Nicholas Prophet. Prophet's 1983 novel, Gardens of Stone, is the basis of the new film of the same name, directed by Francis Coppola. The movie Gardens of Stone stars James Caan, Angelica Houston, and James Earl Jones. The story is a semi-autobiographical account of Prophet's experiences with the military and the Vietnam War. From 1961 to 64, Prophet served on the Old Guard, an elite Army ceremonial unit attached to Arlington National Cemetery. He was part of the pageantry with which old soldiers are buried. Prophet arrived in Vietnam in the early 70s as a correspondent for Newsweek. Like the film, Prophet's novel traces the division the war caused on the home front. I asked Nicholas Prophet if he got the call of a lifetime from Coppola telling him he wanted to make Gardens of Stone into a film.
Well, I found out very indirectly. At first, the word I got was that it was going to be done by, oh my gosh, I've forgotten his
name.
One of the other guys, the guy who did Out of Africa, Sidney Pollack.
Oh, yeah.
Which didn't disturb me much either. He's a fine director, too. But if I could have hand-picked a director to handle my book, it would have been Coppola.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that his other Vietnam War novel is the epic Apocalypse Now. And this movie is, it also concerns the Vietnam War, but it takes place in the Washington, D.C. area. And it's people in the Old Guard on burial detail. It's the exact opposite perspective than Apocalypse Now. There's no fighting in it. And it's also very sympathetic to the military.
Yes, it is. It's not very sympathetic to the Vietnam War, but it is sympathetic to the military.
To the soldiers.
To the soldiers, and especially sergeants, the non-coms, the so-called lifers, who came in for a lot of abuse in most of the Vietnam treatments. That comes out of my own background. My father was a career Army sergeant, and I went into the Army and spent 3 years in it before I went to college. And I ended up a sergeant, buck sergeant, a low one. But so I've had this fascination with and association with the Army all of my life, and I thought that that was a side of things that hadn't been told before. I especially wanted to look at the institution of the Army and get across the idea of the Army as a family and take a look at what the war did to the institution of the Army.
When you found out that Coppola wanted to buy the rights to your book, were you able to find out what it was that attracted him to your book?
I'm not really sure. I haven't really talked with him about it. I think the rituals, it's a book full of rituals, and Coppola's previous work has always had a strong emphasis on rituals, the Godfather movies, for instance, male bonding between my protagonists, that sort of thing has also interested him. He's a very family-oriented director. He's got a very strong sense of family, I know, both in his personal life and in his vision as a director. And I think the elements of family, of the Army as family, and of these people coming together as family members who aren't really related by blood, appealed to him. But I'm guessing for him. I don't really know, but that's what I suspect.
Let's talk about the part of your life that your novel Gardens of Stone and the film Gardens of Stone is based on. It's loosely biographical, autobiographical.
Loosely,
right. So you, in 1961 to 64, served in the Old Guard. Now, what is the Old Guard? Most of us have seen it, but I never actually identified it as the Old Guard before.
No, it's those background people you see in shots of the president when his plane lands or at a White House ceremony. They're the guys standing in the background holding flags or standing at attention. It's basically a ceremonial battalion, part of the 3rd Infantry. It's one battalion of the 3rd Infantry. It's stationed at Fort Myer, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac from Washington. And it does many, many different jobs, everything from putting together a color guard in old powdered wigs and colonial uniforms out at Mount Vernon, to guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, to providing escort platoons for the president when he arrives at an airport or takes off from Washington, to greet heads of state that are coming in. But basically their job is to bury people at Arlington Cemetery to render the final military honors.
Do you have to do the digging when you're in the Old Guard?
No.
Just the ceremony part.
Just the ceremonial part. And even that's broken down. There are firing party teams, and those are the guys that give the 21-gun salutes. And there are casket-bearer teams, and their job is just to carry coffins. There's a caisson section, which handles the horses that are used in the ceremonies. And then there are just marchers who march along as an armed escort.
Were you glad that while you were in the military, your service was in the old guard?
No. I mean, I thought it's a very spit and polish outfit. A haircut every other day, shaving three times a day, shining shoes all the time, uniforms pressed all the time. You couldn't even wear your shoes inside your barracks. You had to go in stocking feet because you might mess up the floor. You had to be ready for inspection all the time. And that kind of thing I thought was rather Mickey Mouse and didn't appeal to me greatly. I was really out of the service before the Vietnam War really got started. As I say, I got out in 64 and the buildup in Vietnam started in 65. So when I wrote the book, I had to I advanced the time a bit because I wanted to get the Vietnam thing in. I wanted to use Arlington Cemetery as a metaphor for Vietnam, as a final resting place for our casualties. And if I had been in the old guard doing those kinds of things during the height of the fighting, like the people in the book and in the movie are, I don't really know how I'd have felt about it. It seems kind of silly to be doing that sort of thing when people are dying 10,000 miles away.
In the movie, one of the sergeants says to one of the young men just arriving, "Welcome to show business."
Right.
Because there's so much ceremony and so much emphasis on clothing. And somebody else says that the old guard is the kabuki theater of American arms. Now, was there a lot of sarcastic comments like that when you arrived?
There were, because there are a bunch of, there's always sarcastic comments from young soldiers, no matter what they're doing and where they are. There was a lot of toy soldiers talk. But at the same time, I think almost every man in that unit knew that the requirements to be accepted were quite strict. You had to have a certain military bearing. You had to be a certain height. I was very surprised that I was accepted into it simply because I wear glasses. And today, that's not really a hinderment. If you wear glasses and you're assigned to that unit, they issue you contact lenses and pay for it. But at that time, I don't even think contact lenses had been invented yet. But I wore glasses, and as a result, did not get to do any of the high visibility things like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or casket bearers. I was always in an honor platoon, and more often than not, in the back rank where you couldn't see me very well.
My guest is novelist Nicholas Prophet, and his novel Gardens of Stone has just been made into a movie. The military is usually seen as a testing ground for young men to prove their manhood. And I wonder if being in such a ceremonial position as the old guard made you feel like, well, I'm not really going to get to prove my manhood here, because what we have to do is spit polish our shoes and dress sharp and be immaculate. It's the kind of thing that's looked at as being very fey by men who want to prove their manhood.
Well, there wasn't really a hot war going on at the time. There were some crises while I was there. There was the Berlin Wall crisis to begin with, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a lot of anticipation and jumpiness and uneasiness about what could happen, but nothing actually really did happen. And we did have some advisors in Vietnam. In fact, most of the officers and senior NCOs in the old guard had been in Vietnam as advisors, early advisors in the early 1960s, 61, 62, that sort of thing. And the honor guard was, I guess, their reward for faithful service in Vietnam. It was seen as a very high profile post where a man should feel honored to be there. Number one, for the officers, and you were not very far from the Pentagon and could sort of keep an eye on your career at close hand, and who knows, maybe even meet somebody who could influence it. So it was a prestigious posting.
Did you wanted to be in the military because your father had been, and you wanted to carry on the line?
I had the idea originally of perhaps even making it a career, and my 3 years in the service cured me of that. I've had this love affair with the Army all of my life, except for the 3 years I was actually in it.
One of the characters in your novel really wants to go out to the front in Vietnam, and of course his senior officers keep telling him there is no front in that particular war.
Did you ever want to, I know there wasn't a war raging at the time, but were you frustrated by that?
No, not really. I was never quite as naive or as gung-ho as that young character in the book. He's almost too naive, a caricature of all that martial feeling that young men have, which is countered by voices of experience who've actually been there. No, I didn't really have. The very thought of combat made me a little nervous. And when I got to Vietnam as a reporter and had my fair share of shooting fracases, I didn't like it very much.
Hey, before we talk about your experiences reporting in Vietnam, I want to talk a little bit about your reaction to the movie that's based on your book. Now, you've had the opportunity to see it how many times?
I've seen it 3 times.
So what did you think of the movie?
I'm not really sure, Terry. It's I'm so close to the material. The first time, I wasn't very pleased. That was my overall reaction. I was basically looking for the changes and where they changed the material around, and I didn't see it very clearly. The second time I saw it, I liked it better. And the third time I saw it, I liked it even better. So another 4 or 5 viewings, and I'll consider it a masterpiece, I'm sure.
That's right. But, keep going, it'll be
that's
great.
That's right. Most people, if you haven't read the book, then you just go see the movie and you judge it as a film. If you have read the book, then you've got different things to balance off against each other. If you've written the book, you really have a lot of baggage that you're bringing into the theater with you. So I'm not sure. As I say, I like it better each time I see it. And I really appreciate a couple of performances, and I think both James Caan and James Earl Jones are superb in it. I've never seen them better.
Did you want to know, who's playing me?
There wasn't really a me. There was one me was me at sort of 19 years old, and another me was me at 40. The casting, I wasn't quite sure about the casting. James Caan hasn't made a movie in 5 or 6 years, and he came out of retirement for this. He really wanted that role, and I think I know why now, because he just disappears in that role. You don't really think that you're seeing James. You don't think about James Caan being up there. They came very close a couple of times to signing Paul Newman to play that role, and Paul Newman is a very fine actor, but I, for one, can never watch him on the screen without somewhere in the back of my mind saying, that's Paul Newman. Caan, there is no sense of this is James Caan playing a role. This is he just disappeared into it.
No, I don't think we've really explained what the story of your novel is about. Do you want to do that?
Oh, my gosh. It's a young man, a young soldier, whose father was in the military, reports to the ceremonial unit in Washington, and is taken under the wing of a couple of older experienced sergeants who were friends of his father, and they sort of shepherd him. Well, he's very anxious to get on with his career and get to Vietnam, as it's the middle of the Vietnam War. He'd rather be fighting it instead of burying its casualties, which is what the job consists of. The two older men are cautioning him and trying to slow him down and give him some sort of sense of reality. They've both been in Vietnam as advisors before, and trying to give him a sense of things not going right over there. They already have a premonition about what Vietnam is doing to the country, and more important to them, what it's doing to the army. It's tearing their army apart, and they consider the army their family, and it's a family affair, and they don't like to see their family in trouble. And they befriend this young man. He learns some things and doesn't learn other things, and finally goes off to war.
We'll talk more about your movie in a couple of seconds. We're going to take a very short break here. And my guest is writer Nicholas Prophet. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas Prophet. His first novel, Gardens of Stone, is the basis of a new film of the same name, directed by Francis Coppola. The story is based on Prophet's tour of duty in the Old Guard. He served on burial detail at Arlington National Cemetery. During the 70s, he reported for Newsweek. From 71 to 72, he reported from Vietnam. He returned there to cover the fall of Saigon. You know, one of the things in the story of Gardens of Stone is that the soldiers who are on burial detail all the time, as you were, their attitude towards the people who they're burying changes. as I start to realize that it's them, you know, it's people like them, it's people who they know. Did you go through anything like that yourself? And I wonder what it's like to preside over burials of people who are totally anonymous to you. And it's a ritual you perform day after day. It's like theater, really.
You went through the first funeral was a very moving and shattering experience and terribly poignant. In fact, I think tears came to my eyes the first funeral I pulled. There's the full panoply of ceremony and the rendering of taps and the black stallion with the boots backwards in the stirrups and the rat-tat-tat of the drum. It's very moving. By the time you've done your 100th, tend to become a little irreverent toward the whole process. The old guard, we called burials drop jobs. We called the cemetery itself either the boneyard or the garden. And we were burying 12, 13, 14 people a day. I wasn't around to bury people when the war was going on, although my characters in the book are. I don't know what I would have felt if the people we were burying were our age. Most of the people that I was burying as an 18, 19-year-old in 1961 and 62 were older men. They were colonels and captains and sergeants, men who had done 20 or 30 years and had died from natural causes brought on by the kinds of illnesses that older people are prone to. I don't know what the reaction would have been if the casualties had been 19-year-olds just like myself who had been killed in a war while I was in a very cushy post stateside and these kids were over in Vietnam. I also remember the first time we used to bury infants too, children of military personnel, where normally there are eight men on a casket as a casket burying team. And when you've got a coffin a foot or 2 feet long with an infant in it, that was rather sad too. But when you first started doing it, it was very poignant, moving ceremony. As you kept doing more and more and more, you became more and more cynical about the whole thing. And you made up little ditties and irreverent remarks that you were careful not to let the next of kin hear. But
what kind of ditties?
I don't know.
Fit or not?
No,
huh?
No.
Okay. Well, you know, it's one of those really ugly ironies that while this movie was being filmed about people on burial duty, that the director, Francis Coppola's son, was actually killed in, I think it was a boating accident.
Freak boating accident, yes.
And I can't imagine what it was to film the rest of the movie after that happened.
Especially, yes. I was on the set a few days after that tragedy, and it was a very somber set, of course. I had expected maybe that Coppola would have shut down production for a while. Instead, he took off a day. They had a very nice service for his son at the Fort Myer Chapel with the entire old guard in attendance. And then he went right back to work and worked around the clock for a week and then sort of had a little collapse, went into an army hospital for a couple of days, rested up, got plenty of fluids, whatever, came right back and started right in again. It became I think the movie became a testimonial to his son. But it must have been very, very difficult for him to, number one, losing a child is probably the worst thing that can happen to a person. And then to be spending your days following that, surrounded by gravestones and filming funeral scenes, it must have been very, very difficult.
In your life, you were in the military before the Vietnam War escalated, but when you finally got to Vietnam, it wasn't as part of the military. It was as a reporter.
Right.
What was your position on the war by the time you got there for Newsweek?
The position of my generation in general was that the war was a mistake, that it wasn't working out. I think it was fairly obvious by that time. I went to Vietnam with the idea of being an objective reporter and making my own decisions, but I think I was predisposed to thinking that the war was a colossal mistake, a misadventure for our country. When I left 2 years later, I had not changed my mind at all. I still thought it was a colossal mistake. I think that the way I got to my decision was a little different than before. For instance, I had a great deal of respect for the American fighting man and for the kids that were over there and what they had to go through. Not very much respect for the politicians and some of the higher brass involved.
You know, you were describing Gardens of Stone as, in a way, being about the military as family and the ruptures in that family that were caused by the war. Your father was a career military man, and I imagine there were probably ruptures in your family when you were against the war, especially when you were reporting from Vietnam.
Not really. I avoided all that by having,
by being in Vietnam?
No, but by having my father die on me. He died in 63. I remember it very clearly because I was home for his funeral when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I got called by my unit off of my father's funeral. He had been buried, but I was still helping my mother do some administrative things, and I got called away because they needed every available body to back at Arlington to participate in the state funeral for JFK. They hadn't pulled a state funeral like that for many years, so they were blowing dust off the procedure books and panicking, running around panicking. So in a way, I'm almost glad he didn't live to see it. He loved the Army very much. He was a veteran of World War II and of Korea. And I don't think he could have taken what the Army went through in Vietnam.
When you were reporting in Vietnam, did you spend a lot of time thanking your lucky stars that you were there as a reporter and not in the military?
Yes, of course. I spent a lot of time out in the field with the troops. And part of my job is actually go looking for trouble. I probably saw as much, if not more, combat than the average GI who was over there, but I never forgot that I had that option to get out, to bug out anytime I wanted to. And I exercised that option a couple of times where I thought that this was a no survivor situation and caught that last resupply helicopter out. And I felt badly about it, but not badly enough to stay. And one time when I left, there were about 15 people left, and they were all killed. And if I had stayed, I'd have died.
Were they all reporters?
No, they were all soldiers, and I'd gotten out on the last resupply helicopter.
Did your military training come in handy as a reporter?
Not much. I did not, as a matter of principle, carry a weapon. I was a reporter, not a combatant. I had some trouble with some of the units I went out with. They didn't want to carry me along unless I armed myself, and I just refused. And usually talked them into letting me come along anyway. It helped a little bit. It helped, certainly helped in my reporting, yes. I knew some basics about strategy and tactics and small unit maneuvers and that sort of thing. So it did help.
When you were reporting for Newsweek, you were already opposed to the war. Did you have any editorial problems with what you were reporting? A lot of people back in the States, you know, hadn't been there and didn't.
No, I mean, I don't want to leave the impression that I was going to slant that reporting to fit my bias. I had a mild basic bias when I went over there that the war was a mistake. Nothing I saw while I was over there led me to think any differently. If I had found evidence to the contrary, I'd have changed my mind. I did change my mind I did not agree with some of my friends. When I'd left the States, a lot of my friends gave no credit at all to the troops who were over there. They were baby killers and this and that. I had a lot of arguments when I came back with those kind of people. I wouldn't listen to that kind of talk. It was nonsense.
You spent over a decade as a reporter, about 4 years in the military, and now you're basically a full-time novelist, and you're doing well enough at it to remain a full-time novelist. Why do you want to be a novelist as opposed to writing nonfiction or continuing reporting?
I always felt that the canvas in the reporter's canvas was a little too small for me. You had to be a successful foreign correspondent, which I spent 10 years abroad, and that's what I did, was report mostly wars and coups and earthquakes and third world disasters and that sort of thing. When I found something that interested me, my personal inclination was to stick around and look at it for 6 months and study it from all angles and really get it down. And when you're a foreign correspondent, there's just not time for that. You come in, bang, 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 do the story, wrap it up, become an instant expert in 48 hours, write a story that sounds as if you've lived there all your life when you hardly really know what you're talking about, then move on to the next trouble spot. And there was never an opportunity to actually light anywhere and really get to the bottom of things. As a novelist, I can do that. I can go and I can make that canvas as large as I want. I can tell the whole story. I actually truly believe that through fiction you can get a lot closer to the truth than you can through nonfiction.
Well, I wish you the best with your writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for visiting with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been writer Nicholas Prophet. His novel Gardens of Stone is the basis of the current film Gardens of Stone, directed by Francis Coppola. This is Fresh Air.